Chapter 4, Yoga Mind. Take your non-dominant hand and try to press the index finger and middle finger together and separate them from the ring finger and pinky, which are pressed together, a V-shape with two fingers on each line of the V. Spock used to do this. Make it flat. Not too hard. Now, press the ring finger and middle finger together and separate the pinky off by itself and the index finger off by itself. Make it flat. Can you do it? Apply yourself for a moment and you'll get these. They require a bit of concentration as we tease muscle groups apart which usually work together. This act of leaning into our nerves so we can come up with something novel by teasing apart something that usually works as an unconsciously composite piece is an act of tapas, and I will call the region upon which it works a tapas field. Tapas is a Sanskrit word which means glowing fire or heat, and is used by yoga to convey a transformative act of concentration. The fire that will burn you clean, will burn you both toward higher personal development and deeper spiritual realization. The tapas field here is this, that moment where you can't quite get the middle two fingers apart. The fingers don't just jump to it because they don't yet know how. An act of learning something we can't do yet. The Ashtanga system is designed to always have us up against this field. Learn through a teacher-assisted self-practice setting, Mysore style. The student basically gets the green light to progress through the asanas until she encounters something she can't do. At this point, progress through the series stops, and she stays there until she learns at least basic competency with a difficult thing. She learns to do something she can't do yet. An act of evolution. As the progressive series unfolds in Ashtanga, the degree of asana difficulty becomes an insurmountable curve, and even the most willing and gifted yogi eventually peaks out and gradually slides back down. Tapas is built into the system. After succeeding at the Spock finger thing, we can move on to greater tease apart challenges. A good one is Urdhva Mukha Svanasana, up dog. Tries to tease apart firm squeezing of the thighs with total relaxation of the buttocks. For people with tender lower backs, this is a good skill. Mula Bandha goes further. If Ashwini Mudra is the anal complex of muscles and Vajroli Mudra the urogenital complex, Mula Bandha is recognized to the cervix for women, apparently not the easiest thing to do, the muscles further back at the base of the penis for men. Try teasing those apart. 1. Genitals from anus. 2. For women, the cervix from the muscles that hold back urine. For men, isolations between the front and the back of the root of the genitals. You get the idea. Check Mula Bandha by Swami Satyananda Saraswati for more than you ever thought you wanted to know about this, as well as reasons why one would want to pursue it. We can then move into the lungs, a movement which will take us from the gross physical level into the next level of subtlety, the pranic layer, hence pranayama. Hold your breath until you feel the urge to breathe. Notice the nature and quality of this set of urges and the associations that may come with it. The prana, the life force that comes from breath, is fairly important. Hold your breath for a while and you'll see what life is like without it. Nasty, brutish, with an emphasis on short. Tease apart 1, a deliberate, relaxed decision to resume breathing from 2, the unbearable need to react to the urges. I see this as a very easy way to get right at the heart of yoga, an intentional exercise of pushing ourselves all the way to the edge of life in a highly safe and contained manner to open a laboratory of reactions in which we can train ourselves. Every little reaction urge not acted upon is growth of yoga. Hold your breath long enough and the Grim Reaper himself shows up. What better teacher? And how great that you can get him after only a few minutes. All yogas of any depth directly address death, and some even flirt with it. And the irony is that such death-encountering practices release and assimilate fear-trapped life force rather than destroying that life force. It gives us a chance to get over it, which is incredibly freeing. And then moving to the biggie, teasing apart what I will call yoga mind from discursive mind. This too requires that sense of bearing into, a quality which will be a joy and a rapture at times when we are up to it, and a burden requiring discipline when we are less inspired. It includes a sense of taking on inner work, driven by the intuition that we are following an evolutionary path. is the act while sitting or doing asanas with trying to quiet your mind. Not easy, especially during the first few years of practice. Why do this? I'll present the idea that yoga mind, although to varying degrees an aspect of the experience of many of us throughout life, is a way of being that can develop deliberately and stably as an accompaniment to the development of discursive mind. Yoga mind is a possible option after a degree of development within discursive mind, and a necessary step for those who want to gain true body-mind integration, an alluring beacon for sure. In most people, these two minds are enmeshed, fused together, and is the tapas of trying to quiet the discursive mind that allows them to separate. This separation enabling a higher integration is at the heart of the Hatha Yoga mystery, the relation between the deeply somatic and the spiritual. If cultivated, yoga mind can develop the capacity to unleash and manage potent psychosomatic energies which have the potential for immense positive effects on physical and mental health. And it makes possible sufficient caring ability in the body-mind of the practitioner towards sustaining and embodying the states of higher spiritual realization promised to us by the yogis and sages throughout history. And without the hard work of teasing the two minds apart, discursive mind muddies up the needed information and results will be very limited yogically. What level of discursive mind is required before we can enact yoga mind? Research around the WC lattice has shown that individuals at many levels of personal development can develop spiritual abilities, a basic one being the deliberate capacity to quiet one's mind. At some point, the individual, instead of just thinking, must be able to recognize the option of not thinking. Such self-motivated recognition requires more internal awareness than most people possess, but appears that people at many levels of personal development can enter a yogic tradition and be taught to value yoga mind and get good at it. I'm using the term yoga in a broad sense here to mean many of the multitude practices whose historical roots can be traced to India, including meditation and mindfulness. Now, I also want to mention again at this point that within the yoga tradition such a student may encounter, we can roughly sketch out a continuum between two kinds of schools, with which the yoga mind I delineate in this chapter would be considered on the gradualist end. Hatha Raja Yoga traditions, including Ashtanga, as well as Vipassana meditation, reside here. The other pole can be called inquiry or pointing out traditions, which include Dzogchen, Zen, and Ramana Maharshi's practices. Gradualism was characterized by Tabby Joyce when he talked about cleaning, cleaning, cleaning. It digs deep into tangible felt karmic residues within and clears them gradually, eventually getting the practitioner to the highest internal states and to enlightenment by removing the inner obstacles and building yoga structure. On the contrary, the inquiry traditions discovered that one need not do this to achieve a consistent residence in enlightenment, and instead emphasized pointing out who it is that exists at the root of all living and striving. Having already outlined my personal bias for gradualism in the previous chapter, suffice to say here that both kinds of practices appear to work, each within their own strengths and liabilities. Also, by taking non-discursive efforts and placing them in a Hatha Yoga context, the object of meditation and the content of yoga mind, as I want to present it naturally, becomes bodily sensations and states which range from gross to subtle. The Sanskrit word for this is vedana, a complex term that includes the idea of internal subtle feeling. Go back and see that chapter get clear on that. Vedana is a field which, like all fields, is in constant flux. The act which focuses on the field also changes the field. All of these are discursive mind. None of these are yoga mind. Yoga mind is the great other to discursive mind, to language and logic mind, to associative and sensory recollection mind. It can be seen as the often ignored ground of discursive mind in all its varieties. As such, yoga mind, specifically isolated and cultivated, is a great other to almost all of that which has been generated by Western culture. In the history of the West, some cloistered monks, dancers, athletes, musicians, painters, manual laborers, alchemists have gotten close, but their expressions of it haven't been as clear as those that have come from the East, although the final highest stages of realization, or at least mind-body integration, may have been equally realized. Plato and Plotinus are every bit as astute to levels of subtle consciousness as any Vedantin, but they lacked a yoga, a step-by-step method anywhere near as lucid and effective as we find in the East. The Western Vedantists, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, also reveal a highly sophisticated spiritual perspective, partly informed by then-current European Orientalist research, but again, their yoga appears to consist of philosophical research, teaching, and writing, with some lucky such practitioners gaining privileged access to elite knowledge. Philosophers Husserl and Heidegger and some of their followers flirted with yoga mind, but their project can hardly be seen as adequate enough in the non-discursive direction to call yoga. Also, many pot smokers have gotten a strong taste of yoga mind. Eastern yogic cultural items have had a funny way of popping up in stoner circles of the West, tracing from the advent of the hippies. Undoubtedly, this is because pot and other psychotropics can open the door to yoga mind, generating flashes of dramatic, visionary versions of it. The West has certainly had its share of mystically informed religious people, and the Plato into Plotinus worldview is not far from Vedanta, and even offers perspectives not clearly found in the East. A highly valuable, dynamic spiritual landscape can be found from Augustine through Aquinas, which I hold to be an accurate representation of the territory yogis will find themselves traversing today, with a living God behind it all. A far subtler and better account than bearded God sitting out there on his throne fairly unhappy with women. This is also the case with the Catholic mystics and Kabbalists. Typically following their own inner path with guidance from their given traditions, Western mystics have often arrived at a spiritual outlook quite similar to that of the East once we look beneath surface cultural forms. Conceding this, my efforts to clarify and teach what I'm calling yoga mind are largely about finding an accessible and durable evolutionary engine that anyone can work to put in place which will help her along the spiritual path in a stable way. That doesn't mean it's easy to realize so much as it's easy to recognize. Yoga mind is not easy. My biggest beef with the West is that the stairway to heaven, quote unquote, is not clearly spelled out and has indeed often been outlawed. So, although the spiritual life is typically associated with right brain, poetic associative mind, the yoga mind I'm getting at is closer to a somatically grounded, non-discursive mind, which is less about right or left brain and more towards a mind learning to differentiate raw sensory information from the other data streams processed by the brain and to arrest the application of categories before they start. As a basic human capacity, aspects of yoga mind aren't all that strange to Westerners so much as the Western experience of it never really had the discursive and outward sensate, i.e. outward vision, outward hearing, etc., aspect explicitly teased out of it so that its own intelligence could be experienced in its purity. Perhaps Western philosophy's greatest strength is its mind-altering insights into sensory experience, one of which is that all outward sensing is really an internal representation within our minds. Seeing a tree is to actually reconstruct a concept of a tree from colored patches picked up by our eyes. There's actually no such thing as external for us, it's all internal. Even sophisticated scientists recognize this. Within this realization, we can then make a distinction between representations of the outward world and those within our own body, the latter of which lie predominantly within the domain of internal feeling. For example, we can feel the food we just ate in a representation based on the nerves in our belly. In yoga mind, we are trying to get as close to that representation as possible. So at first, yoga mind is a state of focused attention to the experience in the present moment, as close to the root of our perceptual capacities as we can get. It might be seeing the field in front of us, as it is, just looking, with a minimum degree of interpretation or need for it to be different. This can also apply toward hearing, or touching, or tasting, or smelling. But at a certain point, these outward senses are folded into an inner sensing which is based on internal sensation, pratyahara, the fifth limb of Ashtanga, taking outward senses and turning them inward. Based on the data that the nerves take in from inside, based on Vedana. Again, crude forms of internal sensation include feelings in our belly when it's full of food, or the stretched sensation in our hamstring as we do forward folds, two examples of the most rudimentary forms of internal somatic sensing, interoception and proprioception. Not outward touch, like running fingers along a textured surface, but inward feeling. This makes the somatosensory cortex the part of the brain that is the mature ground for yoga mind. The one tendency that is almost universal in spiritual literature of higher states is that we must feel our way into the higher states of being. Just thinking about it is not going to cut it, and close examination of the content of outward senses won't either. Incidentally, by feeling, I'm not talking about feelings, i.e. emotions, but rather data from somatic nerves, which is one part of emotional experience. Now, raw sensation, such as full belly, or stretching muscles, or simple nerve discomfort, or delight, is the predominant form of cognition in infancy. Needless to say, cognition steadily gains in sophistication, hopefully, as the individual grows and develops, moving beyond mere sensation and often negating aspects of the somatic sensation process itself, unfortunately, and giving rise to the discursive way of viewing the self and the world, which includes internal sensate data among other kinds of information in the calculations it makes. We could call this the basic cognitive capacity, an ability to turn attention to various fields and begin to work them out using different kinds of data and thinking. This can evolve from quite crude modes, which only accept particular and limited forms of data and arrange it in stereotypical ways, to incredibly broad and complex functions at humanity's front edge. Some people are highly aware of the bodily sensate data parts of their cognition, others less. The discursive minds of some people are quite grounded, others are out there. And here we come to the crucial required act, and a radical move it is for many Western minds. It involves the psychological concept of fusion, which I was getting at earlier in this chapter. Fusion is a condition that is necessary and unavoidable at each point in development, and is only viewed as fusion when seen from a higher state of development. So if you never tried to do Spock fingers, you would never wonder about your inability to do it. But the moment someone shows it to you, you become aware of a fusion of muscle groups as you take a moment to tease them apart. Only when you began reaching for the greater differentiation of hand muscles did anything like a fusion become apparent. Before that, you were happily fused. Let's draw the concept into finer material. As a 2-year-old, it was entirely appropriate to scream out, "Mommy!" As an adult, if you get off the phone with her and aspects of yourself are still screaming this at some level, you may well get curious about it. You recognize that some parts of your personality are still fused with Mom. A little fusion item is noticed, drawn into awareness as a result of the basic psychological urge to evolve, in this case, the urge to individuate from our parents. And here's my claim for the teasing apart of yoga mind from discursive mind. Having arrived at the state of mature adult mind, at whatever level, based in discursive mentalese, we remain there for a while before we begin to get itchy for something more. One essential outcome of this urge, and the source of it really, is the internal body-mind evolutionary process itself, which progressively upgrades our quote-unquote operating system to higher, more sophisticated, more adequate to reality levels of thinking and acting. But these are usually just more intricate versions of discursive mind, which can continue upgrading without ever hitting on the possibility of yoga mind. The problem is this: whether we are at rational levels of cognition, or lower, or higher, we are frequently in thrall to the flow of this mind, and it doesn't always lead us in great directions. If we remain in our typical discursive state, we occasionally or frequently get caught in thought patterns that don't feel good, or are akin to spinning our wheels. This doesn't seem to be an issue when we are happy and everything is going well. But happy and going well is frequently not the case. We often find ourselves in less than ideal external and internal situations. These are the times when discursive mind typically does not help, and instead is prone to negative thoughts and unhappy interpretations. We can address this by gaining skill at replacing bad thoughts with good or productive thoughts. We can let our emotions flow and try to understand them. But what about not thinking at all? What about just being? What about the act of simply existing in the present moment and letting go of the mind that needs to think and plan and remember and desire its way through everything? This strikes us as somehow a higher way of being, partly because we begin to get a glimmer of how such a way of being allows traction on deeper material in our psyche. And indeed, this is getting at the ways of being that the spiritual traditions of the East overtly advocate, and those from the West obscurely so. Western psychotherapy has attempted to manage these psychic depths, which can be seen as a sea on which discursive mind sails, complete with storms, surf, sharks, by addressing these depths discursively. Yoga mind addresses them directly with minimum mediation. Yoga mind can be contrasted to the rational, independent inner witness that was born with the maturity of discursive mind as it rose above mythic levels of thinking. Western philosophy has made much of this rational subject and invested immense effort trying to figure out what needs to emerge next, partly based on a keen sense of the limitations of rationality. Ideally, the rational witness can put its attention capacity wherever it chooses, although total freedom as such is quite an accomplishment. But assuming such a level of accomplishment, the rational person could will herself to work on, explore, enjoy whatever she wants. She's the ego and she has her objects freely at her disposal. What could be the problem? The main response in continental philosophy was that rationality's enjoyment was actually quite a bit more removed from life and sensuality than the mythic level of mind which historically preceded it. This was diagnosed to have caused painful and even violent divisions on various levels. Solutions ranged from romantic embrace of nature experience to wild Dionysian orgies to redirections into non-rational thinking. Many of these can now be seen as historical expressions of a reaction phase and the attempt to discover the next level of mind beyond rational, a new mind which clearly needs to have well-developed rationality as an important and foundational component. And of course, all these solutions were still discursive mind. None of them were a sustained, deliberate, focused yoga mind. Here's my critique of the rational witness. I would say that she is a witness that is free on surface levels, i.e. she can read this if she wills it. But if we look at the bigger psychic picture, she is often riding larger waves of primarily self-inflicted karma over which she has little control. If she were to turn her attention away from things to think about, discursive noticings about events and gross satisfaction of needs and urges, and actually hold in attention the deeper movements of the psyche which supports that witness itself, she may very well begin to get a bit shaky. This is material that discursive rational mind can take notes on, point out logical processes about, recognize images and themes, refer to what came before and predict what will come next, and so on. But the deeper aspects of the self, on which this ego depends, have such a strong psychic charge that discursive mind is nearly helpless to take them and transform them. For this, the ego needs a mind which can contact felt reality itself, learn its valence in a wordless manner, and build the strength over time to begin the work of transforming it. This different kind of mind needs to be able to take long excursions away from applying the categories, quote-unquote, and instead just remain with pure sensing itself, and subtle somatic sensing in particular. Nature experience and Dionysian orgies can definitely get us into these deeper psychic layers, but my claim is that even if practiced in a disciplined way, for example by psychonauts who take notes on their trips, the crucial step of struggling to deliberately quiet the mind will never happen, will be haphazard, and not stably realized. I see no way around this, no way of skipping this struggle that yoga puts front and center. So anyway, having spent some time in yoga mind and recognizing the benefits of it, we eventually perceive intrusions of discursive or analytic mind as fusions, as something we would rather not have during meditative moments but can't control, yet. And so the urge, when we are inspired, is to lean into the tapas field of mind control and to seek tools and teachers who can help us with the project of teasing apart discursive mind from yoga mind. I see the Western movement toward yoga as a way of addressing this emergent developmental thrust. Mature yoga mind thinks by constructing complex sensation representations based in feeling but containing inner senses, inner seeing, inner hearing, etc., in response to perceived fields, and crunches such data in processes of integration and resolution that can be felt. One implication here is that the mind is a sense organ, and if this inner process of integration continues, the fields it can sense go way beyond that of the rudimentary mechanical functions of our own body, although it begins with that. What does subtler yoga mind sense? My basic answer: subtle fields received an ever-increasing scope, strength, and collectivity as yoga mind matures. So what I'm calling yoga mind covers a range from getting as close to sensate representation as possible, into grounding the senses in internal feeling, into gradations of refinement of internal subtle feeling that can take on a pan-sensory character. When non-discursive mind operates within subtler feelings, it enters a region that has been called the heart in various global-wide spiritual treatises. This is a place where yogis have often situated the mind, and Patabi Joyce would speak of the mind which is in the heart. Heart thinking is grounded in feeling and is part individual, part collective. The subtler it gets, the more collective it becomes. Discursive mind, now seen as a state of fusion when it interrupts yoga practice, gives way to the work of separating itself from yoga mind. Free yoga mind from discursive mind, then yoga mind has a chance to really get to work. It thinks within the feeling substrate which gets marked up, affected, determined by outward experience, but also by internal thoughts and emotions. It engages felt objects directly, feeling its way into the trace fund that is built up from outward and inward experience, and it transmutes the traces. The greater the focus, the faster and more complete the transmutation of the trace into something more integrated, more evolved. Focus can be intensified with practice over time, and the great yogis attest to how far this can go. How does this transmutation work? Well, as mentioned in the Signet chapter, if we see an outward visual field, that tree over there, we can't really do much to it without picking up a real chainsaw and going mad with ancient antagonisms toward the Great Mother, or better, going over and hugging it, that might do something. But following the fifth limb of the eight limbs of Ashtanga, Pratyahara, which tells us to take outward vision and turn it inward, we can then begin to work on the fields that present themselves. The Tibetans would have us establish inner mandala-like visions and then begin manipulating them. Acute outward vision can help put this in place, but is the inward theater where the work happens. The visual Tibetan yoga mind does inner work, but mostly on subtler levels. With inner sensation, which is closer to the Hatha yoga way, the capacity to feel a full belly matures into the capacity to feel subtle emotions, matures into the capacity to feel the feeling substrates to intellectual work, on up to highly subtle and powerful perceptions of cosmic processes. Let's call this radiant, heartfelt, somatic, vibrational presence, a state of higher and deeper feeling. It is not a negation of the Tibetan Tantra, which relies heavily on the visual cortex, or Nad Yogis, who go with the auditory cortex. For those ways, look up one of those teachers. These sensings begin to move beyond the merely felt and become pan-sensory access to the larger cosmic body-mind, the big collective mind outside of ourselves, of which we are a part. So, we have samskara fields within us of varying size, potency, and quality, which can be transformed with yoga focus. Samskara is Sanskrit for traces left by past actions. Here is where the alchemical roots of Hatha Yoga assert themselves. Samskaras become seen as fusion items, and yoga mind can sense them in their elemental form, and like the complexities of chemistry, many patterns begin to emerge along with a qualitative aspect, i.e., this here samskara is definitely not gold, but a little bit more like shit or static or the crud in the drain of my kitchen sink, but I clearly sense it, and I'm willing to bear attention into it. I'm willing to work with my gross and subtle body in the recognition that these are the theaters in which this transformation process must happen. Thus, asana, mulabandha, pranayama, energy of teacher, energy of a community of at least a few others doing the same, etc. Various methods to get the energy level up so that we can do the work of yoga mind. The samskara undergoes the alchemical process of purification, of teasing apart the strands that are mushed together, of feeling the greater energy that emerges from it as it becomes a finer substance, of feeling the energy that is released as that which was locked up in the crud is revealed and goes to work, of noticing how the other senses begin to emerge with inner feeling, begetting seeing feeling, hearing feeling, taste feeling, etc., of feeling the cosmos come in as another doorway of perception is opened once the blockage is cleared, of feeling the heart quicken and come to life as it instinctively senses something exciting happening which opens its desire to love and feel and engage. The next step here can be to recognize blockages as aspects of a larger tension pattern within the body-mind. A readily recognizable result of application of yoga mind is that of relaxation. Yoga mind can hover over a tense area in the body mind as long as need be until the tension eventually lets go. This kind of steady bearing into a specific body mind location is something discursive mind simply can't do. This overall tension map in the individual can be seen as the collection and history of ongoing attempts to define and limit oneself against experiential onslaught. Today's tensions within oneself indicate that this delimiting project is still happening, and for the most part, this is conducted unconsciously. Yoga mind can follow a tension pattern into the depths, beginning by locating one that is conscious, perhaps in the jaw, and then following it as it leads down into a bigger pattern. By releasing and opening a tension event, the result of making it the object of meditation, channels open, freedom is gained, energy flow expands, the body-mind enlarges. This is one of the things going on inside the life of actual sages who are sitting there doing quote-unquote nothing. Such work can go on into ever more subtle sheaths infinitely, and it may altogether cease at times as the realm of Vedanta's Brahman is entered. Another name for the causal matrix is Brahman, a state of apparent nothingness, the creative matrix itself. Those who come near such a sage, either materially or psychically, may feel something, because intense inner work like this registers in the energy fields of various material locations as it flows through subtle channels, frequently including the general vicinity of the sage's own physical body when she's in tapas mode. Yoga mind and discursive mind are not enemies, although discursive mind, being the default mode of humanity, makes it frequently the target as we go through the arduous winnowing of coming to higher awareness through yoga. The body-mind seeks to move perceived fusion towards differentiation, and such a need will continue to assert itself until purified elements can stand on their own and both minds get a chance to do their work, which eventually will give way to higher integrations. Once yoga mind has been established to a degree, has wrestled itself free from the matrix of discursive mind, the correspondences between the two minds remains intimate. Busy intellect makes yoga mind's work much more complicated. The play in which discursive mind may take delight can result in long, hard labor for yoga mind as it tries to sort out the vibrational chaos left by, for example, addictive impulse gratification, or even intellectual experimentation or fantasy play. Habitual emotional mental patterns can be rough on yoga mind. If the psyche is in the grip of an old negative piece of ruminative history, discursive mind may be playing archaic unfortunate tape loops which are secretly fueled by unsatisfied needs of which it is ignorant, while yoga mind desperately digs down into the psychic dirt, endeavoring to root up the mess once and for all by actually trying to learn to contain the associated psychic charge. If yoga mind succeeds in its adventure, typically by defeating hidden tyrants down there so that their fiefdoms can be free to grow and become more civilized, discursive mind will be ready to engage more integrated bodily forms. At a certain point in mind-body development, discursive mind needs yoga mind. Going the other way, A more sophisticated intellect will allow the potential for a more sophisticated yoga mind, though it makes yoga mind's work more daunting. A deep, masterful yoga mind can make for truly compelling discursive expressions should the individual choose to make them. The process gets subtler and subtler with no apparent end to the subtlety. A couple notes here. The yoga mind I'm referring to here is not absence of cognition. It is rather yoga cognition or alchemical cognition. Alchemical implying precise inner experience of elemental interactions as well as applying the chemical, quote-unquote, that catalyzes the desired transformation, all done without utilizing outward measuring devices. The chemical catalyst in yoga is bare attention itself. It is a preliminary stage in yogic endeavor. It will be conducted along the contours of internal background maps that have been established in our body minds, partly by certain facts of how human nervous systems work, and partly by our cultural inheritance and our own experience. Maps the mind constantly updates beneath our awareness based upon ongoing experience. These maps are part of the deeper levels of mental structure that disappear into the unconscious, at the depths of which discursive mind's resources simply give out. Not just tension patterns, but also imagery banks, basic styles of perception and thinking, instincts. Yoga mind can work its way down to these depths, but this process remains within active yoga mind cognition. By contrast, the greatest attainments in yoga are either immersed in or have access to states of mind completely devoid of either discursive or yoga mind cognition, and which register waveforms on the EEG machine, similar to deep sleep. The gradualist yoga paths would have us work our way through our maps, steadily transforming them at greater depths, in a discursive yoga mind struggle-slash-harmony process until the level of causal sensation or Brahman takes us. Here the work and the struggle ceases. When Patanjali delineates yoga in the almighty second verse of the first part of the Yoga Sutras, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha, quote-unquote, yoga is the cessation of fluctuations in the consciousness, we can see this at three levels at least. One, freedom from distraction. Two, freedom from discursive analytic mind. Three, freedom from any manifestation at all, realization of Brahman. This is given a little more detail later in the sutras in the progression from 142 to 143. A subtler version of what I'm calling discursive mind is referred to by Patanjali as Savitarka Samadhi, concentration mixed with awareness of name, quality, and knowledge. And since this is a kind of samadhi, it must be taken to imply cognition in its finer states, near the end of the game. An accomplished version of yoga mind is the next step, Nirvitarka Samadhi, concentration so that the object alone remains.